Blog Talk Radio.
James Brown. Welcome to the Ron and Don Show. I'm Don Allen in Studio A, and over at Studio B is Mr. Ronald A. Edwards. Mr. Edwards, the weather was beautiful today. How are you this evening?
I can't complain, Don. Great weather. A little bit of rain. Didn't always just rain, if you will. At least the weather's good. I understand tonight, let's just kind of give a heads up to
yes,
our listening audience nationally and internationally and et cetera. We have a guest, and he will be ready to go. You have a couple of items that you want to get there. The way we'll be operating tonight, then, Don, we'll have our guest who will be talking in terms of this whole thing of trauma and mental health and et cetera. And then I have a kind of an examination I'm going to ask him to walk through with me as it pertains to how you actually do trauma, because I imagine that everybody's going to be calling in are involved in trauma operations and know scientifically and clinically what that's all about. So I'm looking, I'm looking forward to the dialogue. And we are on for 1.5 hours tonight. Is that correct, Mr. Allen?
Well, we are, this is a special 90-minute program tonight, Mr. Allen, which you're exactly correct.
All right.
Yes.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
Well, you know, I was looking around. Yeah, I was looking around today, Mr. Edwards, at the Chicago Tribune, because I get a feed from there. And there was this article, it says, possible key to black boys' academic success, hire black men as elementary school teachers. And this Dean Tatum out of the University of Illinois at Chicago, let me just read this paragraph just to so you can get the impact of how amazing it is what they're doing to try to increase the black teachers. It's as modest as it may seem. That change is an example of what supporters say could solve the daunting challenges confronting African-American students, particularly boys across the country. Spurred by Tatum, University of Illinois at Chicago, Dean of the College of Education, the school aims to invest about $1 million in an initiative to recruit and train male elementary education majors of color, similar to how universities recruit and train star athletes. Now that's the bomb right there, Mr. Edwards. Yeah, if they could put that kind of money and get that kind of recruitment going, it would change just the whole complex. Because right now, it's a little shaky out there, 2% across the country, black African-American or black American male teachers. And, you know, we have 30, 40, 50% of the population is of color. You're going to have, you cannot be what you do not see. So it's important that we get more teachers of color, especially in Minnesota. With that said, I'd like to bring on our guest, Thomas Berry. I think I met him once, maybe, besides Facebook. I'm not sure, probably did. And he's been talking a lot about the mental health piece and things like that. And I wanted him on the air, Mr. Edwards, because I wanted him to kind of explain this process that, you know, I'm still trying to get in touch with and understand a little bit better. But Thomas Berry, welcome to the air. Welcome to the Ron and Don Show. Don and Ron is over Mr. Hill in Studio B.
Let me just ask this question quickly. Should we address you as Dr. Berry, or do you carry any credentials that you want to have recognized so that we properly identify you and give you, talk in terms of your proper academic credential?
Yes.
Or should we just refer to you as Mr. Berry or whatever? How do you like to be addressed?
You know what? I have no credentials besides just calling me Thomas.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Mr. Allen, go right ahead, and then I'll take over upon your completion with regards to the clinical test and evaluation. Go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Berry, welcome to the air. Before I get into my questions, a couple questions here, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and kind of what's going on and kind of like your topic statement, about this situation, what we've been talking about on social media, what we've seen posted, these grants that are coming out, if you know anything about them. I mean, I don't even know that much about them. But give us a little, like in a capsule, what's happening, what's going on.
Well, the first thing I want to say, Don, is we met, we did meet at, actually, at Harvest Network of Schools at Best Academy. I was second grade. I was actually an assistant teacher, or what they call, teaching assistant. And I was in second grade boys, and you were coming to substitute. So that's kind of interesting, thinking about, the opening of the show and what you guys were talking about. And what I would say to your listeners, just to go back to that real quick, the reason why we don't have black men in schools is because, like any other workforce, if there's a shortage, you normally would pay black men more, right? Because there's less of us.
Oh yeah.
But when you look at when you look at schools in the Twin Cities and everywhere else, for one, African American men normally make less than everyone that's at the school. We're subjected more. The competition amongst black men who are at these schools, who run these facilities, they're trying to get other black men who are strong-minded out as fast as they can, so they can be surrounded by all of these beautiful young black, white, Latino women. It's a real shame what's happening in the schools. And the main thing that I would say is the children are losing because we don't have more black men either teaching or being assistant teachers or just having an effective role in the schools, which I will tell you, when I was at Harvest, my classrooms, you can go back and talk to Ms. Fatu, Dr. Mahmoud. They'll tell you my students at the end of the day was the number two class in reading achievement because I was teaching reading. And we were all – I prepped my students to be for fourth grade coming out of second grade. So, yes, we can be effective in the classroom. It's an opportunity.
Okay, let me –
Mr. Barry, for what his background is. Could you just give us a little bit of your academic background, Mr. Barry?
My academic background is, I majored in history. That's my big thing is just history. I love to study history, so that's my academic background. I got associates in with a history degree, no bachelor's or anything else. But I did run a youth program called SWIM, which stands for Study and Work with Intention and Motivation. I was the founder. I did not ask for a dime for anyone else. We ran it for 2 years out of four parks in North Minneapolis. I paid for every bit for everything that happened. I brought people in to teach the kids social skills, art, health. We talked about business empowerment and development. So I put my own money in it. I put my own time in. So I would say I don't really have too much of an academic background to tip my hat to. I just know that I've been working in this community even when I was a youth. At 14 years old, I was coaching the Pee Wee basketball team and baseball team over at Farview Park, and I was volunteering over there starting at 14. 17, got on the Hawthorne Community Youth Council Board, and I've always had my hand in the community without even asking for a dollar.
Okay, gotcha, sure.
That's great.
All right, Mr. Allen, go ahead. We've gotten what we need. He seems to be a homegrown, if you will. Having been basically raised on the north side of Minneapolis, so he certainly would know a lot about the trauma, mental health, and everything else. But go ahead, Mr. Allen. This is your time.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. And you know, you're talking about the education piece about the teachers, and I do remember that day or those couple days I was over there at that school where you work at. But you mentioned something about, you know, the black male teacher inside the construct of the school system. And I was wondering what would be your thoughts on the universities that have teacher training programs, because I've been through a couple masters, completed 4.0 average, two master's programs, and I was the only black American male in all these classes I took. And I don't see that pipeline. So, I mean, what would be the logical conclusion if the school districts can't hire because there's none in the pipeline? I mean, go to St. Thomas, go to Hamline, go to any one of these teacher training universities. How do we solve that? I mean, how do we even look at that the right way? So the reason why I ask you this, they're kind of rhetorical questions, is because why is Malcolm X said, don't let the enemy teach your kid. I'm paraphrasing a little bit. But why is the education of our K-12 scholars not one of the top five issues in the community? Why in 2018 it's mental health and trauma? And I can go back to 2008 and tell you each year, full years, what the main focus was, what the marching orders were for the black community. So I guess I need to find out where you stand. You need to find out where we stand. We might have a common ground, but I'm looking at this through a lens of, like, I don't understand.
Okay.
You know, I thought housing, you know, why? Go ahead. I'll let you go.
Well, let me tell you a couple things. Yeah, the first thing I would say is I had a conversation with Eric Mahmoud. I want to say I had this conversation in 2015. And the conversation was simply like this. Hey, brother, you hired all these paraprofessionals. You hired all these education assistants to pretty much help your white teachers out. It would be great if you took those same brothers that were in the classroom pretty much teaching in the classrooms. If you could set up a program where you retained us and you sent school so that we can get these teaching license and we can come back and make the school strong so that the teachers can actually reflect the students that you are bringing in. He said, yo, that's a great idea. And I was thinking about doing something like that. And what I will tell you is I ended up leaving because even though I touted that I did those great things while I was there, I didn't get a pay raise. And as a matter of fact, I was making less than other people who was ineffective in the school, right? And they depended on me to do a lot of things, not only in my classroom, but in other classrooms. So we're not there because of the money. That's pretty much what it boils down to. And even when we are effective in these schools, we're just not getting the pay. Teach for America is doing a great job of getting white teachers in the space, but we just don't have any black institutions that are recruiting African-American men and leading them in that path and saying, hey, it's not about the money. It's about generational growth. If we can create the trend of getting African-American men to want to be teachers, we can pretty much change our projections. And that ties into mental health because a lot of things that I'll tell you that I've seen in school, when they say students have ISPs, what I've learned, Brother Don and Brother, is that a lot of that is just learned behavior. A lot of the ISPs is just learned behavior. A lot of the students don't necessarily have learning disabilities. They just have been allowed to and taught how to think and act unhealthy.
I can agree with that to an extent, but now what I'd like to get into a little bit more is why mental health? Why trauma in 2018? What's the big push? Who's pushing it? Who's pushing the button? I'm not saying that the black community does not have mental health issues and trauma. I'm not saying that. But if you look from an organizational design standpoint and synthesize what's happening in the black community economically, education and the systems that are running over there, it can attribute to some bad things happening in the community. You know, we have a couple of murderers on the loose. I think that's a priority. And I'm not getting you to disagree or to agree with me. It's just that I'm trying to find the nexus of this conversation. And that's why I invited you on, because you asked to be on, that you had something to tell us. And we need to know because we're broadcasting live everywhere. Right. And people are interested. Switchboard is lit up, and that's lit up too. So go ahead.
Well, I'll say this. You know, for one, I remember when the trauma came right after, I think we were talking about equity at one point, right? That was the buzzword, equity. And I remember working over at Sun Academy, being the dean of students, as well as on the executive board, and hearing them talking about trauma. And I remember looking at some of it, and I can't lie. I was looking at it, some of it side-eyed, and I was saying, hey, man, you know what? You guys are just trying to do what you got to do to get the money. And then I ran into some of these students. And when you're dealing with students, teaching students that are telling you that every night that they're laying down on the floor, scared. They don't even want to sleep in their bed because of the gunshots in the community. Working with students who witnessed murders or seen their parents murdered, and you start seeing that these students suffer from mental health trauma. And then when I started doing my documentary and working on it, I started finding out that trauma is just not an isolated thing. Trauma is a group thing. So when you meet people who have traumatic experiences who are suffering from mental health, what happens is that trauma gets spread to everyone they come in contact with. We all have to act a little bit different around those people, or we're affected by those folks. Lastly, being a teenager in the 90s, part of the whole Murderapolis phase, and knowing that some of my peers are now finally getting out of prison, a lot of them who have committed murder, the one thing that I do know with my research and my documentary is they have not been treated for mental health inside of prison. Even though a lot of them have been diagnosed as such, they have not gotten the treatment. So when they get kicked back into the community, here we got mentally unstable people who are either going to kill more or they're going to cause more trauma to people who might not have any mental health issues at all. So without us diagnosing it and taking a look at it, man, we're going to struggle through it.
Okay, I have one more question that I'm going to pass over to Mr. Edwards. But, okay, hypothetical. You seem like a visionary to me. So hypothetically here, well, let's just be visionaries. It's summer 2019. There are no mental health issues in the community. There's no mental health issues in the community. They've spent the money successfully, and they've reached out. They've touched everybody. But still no jobs, no housing, no benefits. Okay. What happens then?
Twofold, brother. The first thing I would say is, who gets to decide it's effective or not? The other thing is, a lot of this doesn't even have anything to do with them spending money. A lot of this has a lot to do with just our people being able to have the opportunities just to get help. Because if we have a healthy state of mind, we'll go out and we'll create the jobs. We'll go out and we'll be able to manifest those things. We'll be able to go and sit inside of a classroom long enough to get educated so we can get training. And we'll be able to allow those who are trying to do those things to be able to live a just life without harming them. So I think that if we don't have any mental health issues, you know, that will put us in a good boat. Now, we'll never be able to wipe out mental health, but at the same time, Brother Don, I don't see this being an issue where they can just throw money at it. I'm never a fan of people making money off of other people's downfalls or other people's troubles. So I don't think this is a money issue. What I think more so it is, Don, like I was saying with the ISPs, brother, is I think that this is more of a cultural behavioral issue. And they might not have to throw money at it. We might just have to change the way that we think and operate. We need to get back to the basics and start seeing each other as people.
Okay, okay. I can agree with that. And, I mean, it's a rough world out there. And, you know, I mean, from 2008 till now, I mean, you've had the empowerment zone, which is 2005, I think, to the middle of 2010, if I'm not mistaken. You had the Northside Achievement Zone. And they had trauma there. But let's go back again to 2008. In 2008, there was an African-American men's project to do exactly what, you know, they're talking about today, for men 18 to 31 or something like that in on that range. And we still don't know today what the outcome was. And if any of our callers are listening that know anything about it, please call in. But to be a different system. Now, do you have a network of people that will march in on, say, like the Board of Teaching, that will, you know, understand the linguistics and the necessary reading and research needed to have an intelligent conversation with some senators at the state capitol to try to make some changes and get some help?
Well, here's the thing. I'm looking to help develop that. My main focus right now is just to bring awareness to our people. Because here's the thing, Don.
Okay.
I get exactly where you're going with the empowerment zone, all of that. Here's the thing, and I said this on one of your posts before. White people got to be mad at themselves for the people they decide to give the money to. A lot of time they give money to the people who are all credentialed up, who all talk the way that they want to talk, that's real safe. And those safe black folks, sometimes at the end of the day, they're doing it just so they can have status. And our people don't need more status people. We actually need results. So to me, I feel like if we get into the results business, more so of, hey, you had X amount of time to do this, let us see the results. And if you're not giving us the results, then we should be able to pass the baton, or we need to be able to call an audible on the strategies so that we can get effectiveness. It's hard to have people who don't even mix it up with the people that they're helping, help those folks. I mean, I see it in teaching. You know, you got it, all black people aren't the same. You know, you got a lot of black people who don't even deal with African-Americans outside of their line of work. And those people do not relate to other African-Americans. And you got some black people who aren't even African-Americans, speaking of Naz, right? My man Don Samuels, man, we heard some of the things that he said, right? So at the end of the day, because they black, don't mean that they relate. So we have to be able to get to the table, and then we might have to also start categorizing and saying, hey, you know, when we talk this talk about getting better, we're talking about descendants of slaves. You know, those people that you owe the check to. We can't talk for everybody else. Because I've been in the meetings with the African Immigrant Services. They don't talk about us. They're not bringing African-Americans up whatsoever. They'll talk about Nigerians, Liberians. They'll talk about Kenyans. They'll talk about everybody else. But when it comes to us, they're like, yo, let them do what they're going to do. So we need to formulate that strategy, too. And when we talk, we don't always need to talk for colored people. We should just be talking about African-Americans only.
Great. Mr. Edwards.
Oh, yes. Mr. Berry, you earlier in your dissertation mentioned Murderapolis. So I want to kind of work from that point in time to currently, because you've said a number of things about preparation, developing approaches, and obviously I assume heading towards solutions and resolutions. Tell me, in your mind, what was the failure of the lessons of Murderapolis? And I imagine you were a very, very young teenager back in those days. 1992, how old were you?
In 1992, sir, I was 15. Yes, sir.
And you grew up on the north or the south side?
I grew up on the north side, but spent a lot of time on the south side as well.
Okay. So, back to the question, what lessons did we not learn, and what lessons did we learn from Murderapolis and those deaths, particularly, what was it, 1993, 89 homicides in the African-American community? Where did we go wrong? Could you kind of walk us through that?
Well, the first thing I would say is that crime is somewhat, if you look at the statistics, our crime is down. So somewhere in there, we did get the point that killing wasn't the answer, right? So culturally, we kind of tilt on the killing a little bit. I mean, I know social media has made a lot of things seem worse than what it is, and I blame social media for even passing on a lot of the trauma that people have to experience. I think we've learned from that aspect, but then I thought people got lazy. I think once teen pregnancy went down, once the murder rate went down, what started to happen was we started coming up with these programs, these crackpot programs with people who dress real sharp, they talk real good, but they had no intentions on delivering anything that they walked in and asked for a check for. So a lot of people got a lot of money. A lot of people got rich off the suffering of people. A lot of out-of-towners, by the way, got paid, you know. But when you look at the – you go into some of these parks and you look at what the programming at the parks, they don't even have a youth live programming. You kids go from home to the parks to play video games. Imagine that. Where are these kids learning about things that we learned about, like hygiene? Where are these kids learning about, you know, social skills? These are all supposed to be things that Park and Rec is supposed to be leading. They cut a lot of those programs. The Youth Line program is pretty much on life support. You go into the schools, and you see a lot of the programs that they used to have in the schools that would help those troubled youth excel. They cut a lot of those programs. So what ends up happening is, we are saying, well, we're going to put it back on the parents. Well, if you look at the parents, and I know this is going to sound real controversial, but the one thing about a crackhead parent was a crackhead parent knew that they were doing wrong. And a crackhead parent, knowing that they were doing wrong, would accept a Don Allen coming to them and talking to their youth. Today, we got a lot of selfish parents. They're not high on crack. They may be high on some opioids, or they might be high on some pills, or they just might be high on social media. But the selfish parent don't know that they're doing anything wrong. And those are the parents who are blocking the youth from getting that education outside of the household. So when we start seeing these shootings and we start seeing this spilling over all this, this comes directly from the parenting and the parents not being able to have the access to give their kids the resources that they can't teach, and they probably didn't pick up themselves.
All right, let me do this because we've got an hour and a half tonight to purposely. Have you ever lost a friend or a loved one to violence?
Yes, sir. As a matter of fact, I just celebrated 22 years since the last time I got shot in my hand and my stomach. I've lost a plethora of friends to murder. I had one friend that was murdered by the cops. I had a few friends that were murdered by other friends. My brother, whose birthday today, he killed one of our childhood friends inside, I think it was, I want to say 2003. So, yeah, I know definitely about murder. And that's what my documentary is on, what happens to people after they commit murder.
Now, when you say documentary, you're talking about something that will appear on TV?
Yeah, I've already reached out to PBS. We've already in the works of getting
uh-huh.
them to air the documentary.
All right, let me ask you these series of questions.
Okay.
Because you've had a long experience in basically raised and born and raised in Minneapolis. Let's hear your approach on how to deal with some of the trauma. Let me do this with you, and I'm going to make it as quick as possible. Well, we have probably 8-9 minutes. Let's start with the 23rd of June, okay? That was the occasion, unfortunately, of the death of Thurman Blevitz in North Minneapolis, 4800 block of Canton, gunned down by police. And you had said just minutes ago that you lost a friend to the police. I won't ask you who that individual was because we'll concentrate on the Blevitz situation. Based on what you know, how would you have approached the families of both the father of Mr. Blevins and, of course, the family and the mother who's deceased of Mr. Blevins? Did kind of walk us through, how would you have started dealing with the trauma and the pain and et cetera on the night of the 23rd of June?
Well, the first thing I would say, sir, is that death needs to become more intimate. And what I mean by that, it shouldn't be the public spectacle that we started to see a lot of. I think it's when you're trying to get over the loss and grieving of a loved one, the last thing you need is for it to be a social spectacle or a public spectacle. I know a lot
how
of
so,
people.
How so? With a little bit more clarity. A spectacle in what sense?
I know a lot of people mean well with the visuals and everything else. But I think sometimes the family needs time to get to themselves so that they can grieve. They need that space. They need a place where with people like experts. You know, one of the things that I would tell you is in the suburbs, if a kid gets hit by a car and dies, they send in grief counselors to the entire school to make sure that anyone that's feeling some kind of grief can get some help. I would say that's the same thing needs to happen to African American families or that family. I would love to see that happen more so than having people show up with T-shirts and candles. You know, let's get the real work in, because when everybody walks away, that family is still going to be without their child. So while all of those things are nice, it doesn't necessarily deal with the root of helping them out. Yeah, you know, it's temporary hugs. It's temporary attention, but they're dealing with permanent pain. So what I would like to see started, or what I would have done, was I would have tried to get some counselors over to just deal with the family, let them express themselves, let them vent, let them say their things, but keep it intimate, keep it private, let them do, and then when they're ready to make it public, then let them do it public, you know?
So in other words, you maintain that there shouldn't be any proxies or handlers, if you will, and now, but the family would be to do these things that you've just suggested by whom? Because we will immediately hear, even sometime tonight on this program, folks talking in terms of the experts that you just made reference to, who would
mm-hmm.
immediately arrive and begin to advise, counsel
mm-hmm.
the grieving family. How would you do that? Let's say that there is a division within the family. Some people want to, you know, light candles, wear T-shirts, show
mm-hmm.
pictures. Others want to grieve
mm-hmm.
privately. How would you, as a counselor and a person, let's say it was asked by a member of the family to confer with them, counsel with them, and et cetera. How would you deal with that division?
Well, the first thing I would tell them with the division is that everybody's going to deal with grief a little bit different. I mean, that's just the way it is. It affects everyone in different kinds of ways. So I would let the family know, you know, it's okay to disagree. The main thing is, you know, let's see what you need first. Let's also make sure that even when you're out in the public eye, that you're not doing anything that's going to cause you more pain.
Give me an example, please. Give me an example. Let's not generalize. Give me an example of what and how you should conduct yourself out in the public. Just kind of, you know, help us along here as talk in terms of the dynamic.
Well, I would say is the main thing is when you're grieving, don't make it about you. Make it about the victim. Because that's the main thing. You know, that's the reason why we're
point
here.
Point well taken. Go ahead.
We're here for the victim. You know, we don't want it to be like in those comedy sketches where, you know, the person is over crying and, you know, no one's no longer talking about the person that's laying in the ground. Now we're talking about the person that's crying over the casket, talking about, I want to go with you. No, that's not what you really want. So let's not make it a public spectacle about you. And what I would say, a lot of people do that because they have been seeing the wrong things. So we've kind of been culturally grooming people to grieve wrong. And I see a lot of people take.
Let me make sure we hear that in our listening audience hears that. So you're saying, as a person that is well versed on the trauma piece and the mental health and et cetera, that people have been conditioned wrongly, inappropriately, inconsistent with a successful quote unquote counseling and et cetera. Is that what I'm hearing you say? Is that correct?
That's exactly what I'm saying. And the reason why I'm saying that is because there's nothing worse than trying to get over the pain of a loved one and then you have a stranger come up to you talking to you about what they've seen on TV, what they've seen on the internet, and what they've seen. You know, we think that sometimes we talking to people who are close to these folks, they'll tell you, sometimes I'm just trying to let it go. But every time I run into a stranger, you know, that gets brought up. I got to revisit this pain. I got to revisit this trauma. But I believe if we had trauma experts, if we had people like we're talking about going to school for these things, if we had black, counselors that were out that would be on the scene, that would be showing up to the families, I think that would work better than just getting people out.
Let me ask you this, because we want to move with a certain degree of rapidness and et cetera. You kind of touched on earlier in your reflections about there are too many people out here who are making money off of grief, if you will, and trauma. Now, how will these experts be compensated and through what kind of institutional entity?
Well, I would say a couple of things. I would say the first thing is that the compensation should probably be some county or some state department. I think that the experts should also be rooted culturally. I don't think that we don't need to get watered down in black-like folks. I think that's what we suffer from here a lot in Minnesota. We get people who look like African Americans, but they're not actually African Americans, and they don't relate to the struggle. They don't relate to this process. So you have to get people in there who actually relate. Not only do you have to have them relate, but even if they're a county or a state program, they still need to be responsible to the people. So that they should be having quarterly meetings with the people, like we were talking about earlier, letting them know about the progress. Because there's no need to have agencies involved if we can't see the progress. Now, let's grant it, everybody's not going to succeed right away. And failure is a part of trying anything new. No one should be criticized because they fail. The point is, if they're doing everything that they said that they were going to set out to do, if they're meeting those marks and they're not taking the money just running, then we should allow them to either A, keep going, just change the plan, or B, we should just say, hey, we gotta change the plan, get some new people in, but we should not be embarrassing people for just doing their job. You know, failure sometimes comes with.
Right. Now, Mr. Berry, let me just indicate. I mean, you are obviously, I assume you are aware that there are training programs that have been allegedly in existence. Example, over at, I think it's Fairview Hospital, there has been some training going on. There's training at the University of Minnesota, some of it being, quote-unquote, managed by Dr. Pravato, but specifically managed in totality by the legendary Dr. Cicchetti, who came here from Rochester, New York, and who is reflected in the book entitled Medical Genocide. Now, right now, there is $1.6 million in the city's hands. Not the state or the county, but just the little city of Minneapolis. $1.6 million called recast dollars. They're under the supervision of African American woman, and she has her associates and et cetera, and it's coordinated through the Minneapolis Health Department and the city coordinator's office with the and they actually Mr. Allen, Mr. Berry, they actually have a so-called committee which maintains that they vote on who should get the money. I've yet to see a ballot, you know, but it sounded good. Now, the reason I said this, gentlemen, is that, Mr. Berry, I was following closely, as I've always done, the conversation that was going on between many of you on social media, including my associate here, Mr. Allen. And there were some steamy kinds of things being said with regards to how dare anyone even question the need and the importance of, you know, trauma experts and mental health experts and et cetera. So the reason I asked the question, I'm still waiting to have you tell me who it is, what entity, what institute, University of Minnesota, State of Minnesota, who will do the actual certification, because, see, you said something rather interesting when you talked about, you know, we definitely need to reflect the people who maybe not necessarily always of the same, you know, ethnic or racial group, but who have the sensitivity and the heart, I assume that's what you were also saying.
Mm-hmm.
So who will do the certifying? Because, again, now, gentlemen, I have to go back because I was, you know, I understand the implication that Mr. Allen, my associate, engaged in. But the conversations that I've been hearing for the last 3 weeks or so has to do with all of the money that needs to be awarded to deal with trauma, mental health, but particularly trauma, if you will. So can you just help me understand how that will be properly structured so that no one winds up being embarrassed or winds up going to jail for some kind of fraud? Can you help me?
Well, I would say this, sir. I'm pretty sure there's a lot of people who are more suited to answer that than I would be able to answer. But I would hope that it would comprise of a mixture. I think you need some from academia. I think you need some who've worked inside of the prison system. I also think you need some community members. And I think that, so you need to have a board that is a mixture. You don't want one entity over the other. I would also say that the U of M is kind of expensive, and I know that's our big baby here, but we could probably find one of the middle schools to have them run that program so that we can make sure that people can afford to even go through the training, because that's the other side of it too. We don't want to outprice our people who are suffering through this, who live in the communities, who could be the experts. That's the other side of it. And then the last thing that I would say is we need to take people who are working inside of schools, who are working inside of the correctional facilities, who are working inside of some of these social programs, and we need to go ahead and just give them scholarships right away to let them be the first ones to go through it. I think a lot of what happens in the community is that we get kind of outcasted because we don't have either A, the money to do it, or we have the connections. But this is something that's going to take a lot of heavy lifting, and we're going to need all hands on deck. So I think it should be palatable for anyone who wants to be part of it, but it should definitely be reflective of all phases of people who are dealing with folks who are suffering from traumatic experiences.
All right, Mr. Berry, I appreciate that. I appreciate your analysis and observation. Mr. Allen, I hand Mr. Berry back to you, and if our phone lines are open, maybe we'll have some callers. We have decided we do not want to expose you to a bunch of back and forth, because one of the things that you can't do on talk radio unless you really recognize the person's voice, you don't know how many people are really faking, trying to make themselves sound relevant, but have never been involved in anything having to do with counseling or being involved with helping people through trauma and dealing with mental health. So I've told my colleague, Mr. Allen, I'm not interested in us participating in something like that. But I'm going to hand you back to Mr. Allen. Mr. Allen, go right ahead if you want to finish up, and we can thank Mr. Berry for taking his time to be on the air with us.
I appreciate you being on the air with us tonight. We do have a caller, Mr. Edwards. That caller has been with us for the last 9 minutes, and I'm pretty sure they would like to get in. Would you take a call, Mr. Berry?
Yeah.
Hello.
I'm gay.
Okay.
Hi.
Right, we want the call to be respectful and et cetera. Go ahead, Mr.
Yeah.
Allen. You let the call.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Well,
call
we're
here.
Not respectful. I'm going to hang up on him. So call
okay.
me live
Good
on
go ahead.
Phone.
Go ahead, call
what is,
you're live.
And what is your question?
Hi. I actually don't have a question. My name is Shondell Darris. I actually have had the privilege to work closely with Thomas Berry on some of the work that he was putting in. And I just was listening to you guys have that conversation about the money that's being poured in. I have a better insight of what's going on because I am a part of the process. And I like and I approve on how they're doing it this time versus, you know, how it has been done before. But to answer your question, the money that's filtered into the city really isn't dictating where the funds are going to. It's more of a community-based voting opportunity
that
that's
right?
going on currently.
Could you, let me do this, young lady. That's interesting. We've got someone that now is identifying this so-called democratic process. When was the last meeting of the board, and who was it that was awarded the monies, and what was the amount of monies that were designated?
So for the specific program that you're talking about right now, which is the Recast Connect for the trauma, nobody has been
uh-huh.
awarded currently the funding. They are currently doing voting in three different sectors.
All right, let me just say, what you're going to have to do is once you come on the air and you make yourself available to the public, then you certainly have to be receptive to the questioning, if you will. So I'm back to what is the method of voting and how are the individuals eligible to vote and participate in the awarding of this money, $5 million? How are they selected? Please identify and enlighten us.
So the recast, I'm not sure about the total $5 million, but the one that you're talking about that's dealing specifically with trauma right now is a little bit more than $500,000. And what they essentially did is they put a call out to the community, whether you're an organization or an individual, and to put a plan together on how you see trauma being healed. The only requirement was that you were either a resident or you worked either in the south or north side of Minneapolis.
And that amount was $2,500, $5,000, and what was the other amount? I mean, I heard three particular amounts because I think that I'm not quite aware of who you are. $2,500, $5,000, and some people were saying $25,000. What is the amount that is now available and is being voted on? And again, if you would answer my question, how do you become eligible to vote on this federal money and also Bloomberg money? And by the way, I have to tell you that I totally disagree that this process was not in play last year during the summer of 2017. But go ahead.
I'm not sure about last year. I just was brought onto it this year. But like I said before, you either live either in the north or south of Minneapolis. You can either also you can work in the north or south Minneapolis areas,
uh-huh.
And you are eligible to apply for the funding.
Let me ask you this question. I understand. Yeah, let me ask you this question.
Mm-hmm.
Were you one of the presenters at a meeting at the Urban League a week ago? Yesterday, that was sponsored by the Urban League and Mr. Alfred Flowers. Were you one of the young ladies that made a presentation?
I actually was not. I am relatively new to this type of work, but I have a personal story behind this is why I'm doing this work now. I come from corporate. I come from HR. So essentially, I knew that there was trauma that needed to be done that was happening
right?
into my community. Yep.
Uh-huh.
I was personally being affected by the trauma, and I uh-huh. made the decision to start creating the healing that I needed.
Okay, let me ask you this. Whose payroll are you on? You're on whose payroll?
Nobody's payroll.
Oh, you're doing this for gratis? Oh, okay. Okay. All right.
Yes. Majority of my
Okay. I appreciate you calling in, and I mean, I'm not gonna get in. I have like 25 questions, and I'm not going there because I said I'm gonna be a nicer person in 2018. But you know, is let me ask. I have you and Mr. Berry on the phone, and I understand exactly where Mr. Berry is coming from. And I asked him this question, he answered. I'm gonna ask you, what is the number one problem in the black community in Minneapolis?
In my personal opinion, I just think it's the lack of healing from the environment that they're in.
Okay. And they being who?
The people who live in the community. Having to be subject to killings and poverty, you know, and garbage in their neighborhood.
So
and just
you sound like a degreed person, and so I'm going to ask you, say, based on the Northside Funder report, say if 7,000 people in North Minneapolis suddenly got employed Monday morning, this upcoming Monday morning, 7,000, okay, and they spent money in the neighborhood that they lived in, would that have a different effect on this trauma? Okay, so why not double that and make that happen from an economic point? Because, again, I said this earlier in the show, if you spend this money, and we know that trauma and mental health has been around since we got off the boats, okay, has yet to be solved. It's not a solvable problem. And that's why I feel personally the money's going into a sinkhole, where you can invest that in a lot of other things to get people, you know, make people sustainable, can live on their feet, you know, get some boots, to have bootstraps pull up.
And that's the really great thing about this program, that it's just not something that's mental health. There's also behavioral health programs that are a part of the recast that help us understand, you know, our financial traumas. Me personally, I'm glad that you said that I sound like I am a person that has a degree, but I actually don't.
It's not really,
because I've learned that within, there's two ways that you can, you know, be successful, and sometimes education is just not for everybody. But I was able to create a career. I've worked with Fortune 500 companies. I've made pretty decent money. I've at times made more money than my best friend who had a master's degree. Just purely because of the knowledge and the experience that I have.
Okay, all right. Let's do that because we don't want to get into the kind of filter. But I have to do this, Mr. Allen, because the young lady has talked in terms of a short residency with recast. So I want to ask this question, young lady, because you were not able to answer the question when I said what and how does the process work with this so-called election process? How do you become eligible? Tell us a little bit about the relationship between recast and DVI. Can you enlighten?
Recast and what was the other program?
DVI. I think you know the program.
Nope, unfortunately, I'm not aware of that program. I just know that the program, the funding that you were just recently talking about, I know that process. I don't know if you can hear me clearly or if I'm speaking too fast, but the way that you are eligible to be able to vote.
Thank you, because I definitely did not hear you say that. So apparently you've got some information together. So how are you eligible to vote, and how do you become eligible?
So how you become eligible is you are either a resident or you work within North Minneapolis or South Minneapolis areas. That's how you are able to
vote. You know what? How you vote. Go ahead. I'm listening.
Yes. How you vote. They currently have the opportunity online where they're open through the 28th, which is this Saturday. They started on the 23rd, and you are able to vote online. And if you are not able to vote online, they have different opportunities where you can go in. The next voting opportunity would be July 28th at the Sanctuary Church. That's on Broadway right across from Cubs. That's July 28th, and you're able to vote there.
Well, that's the same information that I heard, Mr. Allen, at the meeting at the Urban League. Exactly the same type of information. I am disappointed and shocked that you are saying to the listening audience, and we are worldwide, that you have no idea what GVI is, Group Violence Initiative. Wow. Thank you, Mr. Allen. You can finish it up. I have nothing more.
Okay, thanks for the call, young lady. Appreciate it. Mr. Berry, appreciate you calling in tonight and speaking with us. Want to keep in touch. I'm sure we will. And I know you have an event coming up here shortly. Do you want to tell people about that before you go? Thomas?
Is that the event on the 11th? Is Mr. Berry still with us, Mr. L? I think that's the event that he's having on the 11th.
Yeah.
He has a star-studded panel. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah. And we do have another caller, Mr. Edwards. We've got to have a couple callers here. Let's get those callers here.
Let's get them in. We thank callers. Mr. Berry and the young lady. All right, let's get them in. Let's get the calls in because we're here for a while. Go ahead.
Yep. You're live on the air, 1840.
Yes.
Hello.
Yes, hey, can you hear me? Can you hear me?
I can hear you clear. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Go ahead, 1840.
Yes, I was going to ask the young lady, you know, she's only concentrating on two particular areas, but there's poverty all over the state of Minnesota. She didn't mention Brooklyn Park, Brooklyn Center. These are the same minorities that once they get pushed out of Brooklyn, or well, once they get pushed out of North Minneapolis and South Minneapolis, these are some of the places that they come to when they're trying to escape some of that trauma that she's talking about. And when they get out here, they find out it's hidden poverty. It's nefarious slum landlords, which a lot of these agencies and entities are allowing to have free reign in the suburbs. So the young lady, obviously, she doesn't have a degree. She's not experienced in her history towards the trauma of black people. And just like you said some shows ago, Mr. Allen, some years ago, there's always some Caucasian woman that's behind the scene on these programs.
And you know it.
Now you can say that you're going to be nice, but guess what? I ain't Mr. Nothing Nice. And I'm going to tell you something. Every time these Negroes get some money, they go under the rock, the money gets spent, nothing gets done, and the only thing you see those so-called poverty pimps or self-appointed dignitaries, they buying Chrysler 300s, barbecue, dope, and girlfriends new places to hide out and go cheat on their wives at.
Oops.
So do we have any more slick so-called dignitarian leaders that's getting any more mental health money out there that we don't know about? When are we going to hear from some of those self-appointed dignitaries who've gotten this money, and what concrete plan do they have to do anything? Because what Minnesota is doing is Minnesota is trying to say that, oh, the black community, they're crazy. They need a Rule 20. They need this. They need mental health. And the people that are implementing this, these are the people that's crazy that need some mental health.
All right, sir.
I can't argue.
Just for our international audience, sir, 814, let's let the audience know, our international audience, what is a Rule 20 under color of law?
Rule 20 is, I guess, when they do what they call a psychological assessment in the county on you when they deem you crazy. And they have to use the Rule 20 to find out if you're capable enough to handle your own self in court.
All right. All right. I want to thank you, sir, because we're having some problems with the connection. But want to thank you, and if you get a better line, give us a call. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Ms. Allen, our next call, you said we had someone else. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Ms. Allen.
Yeah. Oh, caller, 1227, you're live on the air. Go ahead. Hello, caller, you're live on the air. I think they might want to listen.
Just like we're having some bad reception, but did you have caller 27?
Yeah, no, they were just did not answer here. Last four, 1227, you're live on the air. You have a question? No. Someone's
yeah, we're having bad reception. Everybody's getting scared. Let's go back to our callers and et cetera. I mean, I was shocked to hear the young lady, whoever she was, indicate she didn't know anything about 2017 and she didn't know anything about the money. I thought that she was, you know, she had acquired selective memory loss, if you will. I was shocked because there's all kinds of written documentation within the archives of the city of Minneapolis about the process, if you will, the
yeah.
so-called board
yeah.
and a secretary.
Okay.
So I'm not understanding why people are standing down from the fact that there was a lot of money awarded last year through the recast.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, but go ahead. You got something going.
Yeah, we got some callers, some more callers coming in here. Let's try
let's
this again. Caller 1227, you're live on the air. Do you have a question or comment? Okay, I'm going to leave you alone. Caller 6699, you're live on the air. Go ahead.
Good evening, gentlemen. How are you guys tonight?
Oh, wonderful.
Fine, sir.
Wonderful.
Fine. I hope
how
you've been
you,
listening
sir?
The whole time. Yes, sir. We're getting an education. Project. What can we do for you, Brother Nelson?
Man, you know, absolutely I've been getting an education tonight, as I do every Wednesday when I listen in. I think, though, man, how poignant it was to talk about the young man that lost his life and going forward, what we need to do going forward to help heal our community. And you know what, to me, it's also baffling is the pickle that Fry has put himself in talking about the releasing of the tape and haven't done so. Having been a young, immature, 30-something-year-old guy that has no experience to boastfully say that you will release a tape, not knowing procedures, the procedures that goes into the releasing of a tape, and now you look like the little kid, his hand has been caught in a cookie jar that dad whooped you real well. So I think that, too, is a problem. Because we have a mayor that says he's on our side, but does it only in moments of convenience. So I think the community, we need to wake up. We got to realize that we have to do things on our own together, include when we lose the lives of young men like this, coming forward with information that you know, any point in information that comes that leads to justice of the assailants. It's not snitching when you bring an assailant that's going around our community and in the lives of young men. It tears down our community when you refuse to tell what you know. It builds up the community when we can get these type of people off of the streets and let our children grow up and live carefree like they're supposed to.
Mr. Allen, do you have any observations for the caller? Because I do have a kind of observation slash announcement in that Mr. Nelson has taken the time to raise the question because we raised the question about Mr. Blevins. Your point is well made, sir, that the mayor got played by the county attorney and the BCA. I've been saying that for the last couple of weeks. It was unfortunate. The mayor now is saying that they'll have the video released. They also should be talking about the cam video because the dash cams in the two police vehicles that turned into alley just after the two police officers, two out of the police officers who were on foot had discharged their weapons. I was shocked that the mayor, who is an attorney, he is an attorney at law, he is a legal practitioner, let the county attorney play that kind of game on him by indicating that as soon as all of the witnesses were interviewed, that you could release it. Well, then the county attorney, Mr. Freeman, turned around and subpoenaed 39 police officers.
Wow.
No one wants to talk about that.
Oh.
Everyone has been quiet. No one wants to deal with that. And we've hammered at it here, if you will. 39 police officers have been called in. Now, of those 39, only two of them were in the alley at the time the shots were fired. You know, it's just about as bad as the Justine situation, which now a $50 million lawsuit has been filed, okay, if you will. And in that situation, the county attorney called 50 police officers who were not only at the scene, but were in and about and knew of the training and et cetera, because that's where that's how they're going to come after Mohammed North. But it just amazes me that the mayor didn't cry foul when the county attorney tricked him and then turned around and said, well, we've got to bring in 39 witnesses, and that'll probably take a month and a half or longer. Now, I assume that the argument from City Hall will be, well, you know, the end of this month, the 30th day, et cetera, will be a little over a month and et cetera. But see, that's not what they meant, because some of the police officers that they have been will be subpoenaing, they've gone on vacation.
Gone on vacation.
Know, they may not be available until mid-August and et cetera. And so I appreciate the fact that that you certainly brought that up. Now, I want to go to our most recent tragedy, unfortunately, at North Commons. I want folks to know that there has been a group of community people that have been working real hard to recover some significant evidence and et cetera to lead to the arrest of the gunman who was involved in this assassination. You know, if that gunman had have turned his gun just a little bit more, he could have killed anywhere from 15 to 20 additional people out there. There were over 200 people out there at North Commons.
My son being included, my son standing merely feet from where the web charged, merely feet
that's,
from
that's
where the
what
young
I
man
understand.
Was.
That's where, because
yes.
A young lady captured him on film. She also has provided, she also captured the gunman himself. In fact, people are trying to reach her and her mother. The mother fled from the scene with the daughter. There was so much confusion. I do believe, sir, that there is a video that shows your son ducking, getting out of the way along with everyone else. But like I said, I'm not understanding totally what is expected to happen with regards to the trauma. The young lady who called in, who obviously, you know, sounded like a plant, must not have known, Mr. Nelson, Mr. Allen, that we are well-schooled on how much money is at play. You know, I heard her statement when she tried to say, I don't know about the $5 million. That's the amount of money that this city got. And by the way, the GBI program has been designated and is moving to the city of St. Paul.
Is that right?
That's
is
right.
Is that right?
That's right. GBI will be going over to St. Paul. Yeah, that whole operation is being shifted and will go under the direct control and authority of Sasha Cotton.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
In fact, there
so what are they expecting?
Going on last night. In fact, Mr. Nelson, you probably saw some discussions going on in which a group of young men from St. Paul are now positioned to become the sponsors and controllers of the GBI program St. Paul. There will no longer be a GBI program in Minneapolis. I had to do that, Mr. Allen, based on the sham that some people tried to run on us just now.
Okay. And, you know, M has been on hold for a long time. Hold on, Mr. Nelson. M has
okay.
been on
All right.
hold for a minute here. And so,
all right.
Well,
thank
with
you,
Mr.
Nelson. Nelson. All right. All right. Thank you. Thank
All right.
you.
Hey, M. M, you're live on the air.
Oh, gentlemen, yes. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for recapping, you know, what's going on in our city. I enjoyed the gentleman you had on. But I think in a lot of ways he's kind of scratching the surface. I mean, we continue to be in an abyss. We continue to be in you know, a situation where we wait around for someone to bring us something. You know, we don't seem to be in a mindset of going out and having a plan and deciding what we need to do for ourselves. And this is the thing, as I continue to listen to, you know, the politicians, I continue to listen to the people on the news, I continue to listen to, you know, I mean, nobody's going to bring you a job. You know, nobody's gonna come to your house and knock on your door and say, "Do you want to work for me? Do you want?" And if this salary is not enough, I'm going to give you a raise. If it's, you know, we have to really get in the game And so far, you know, the things that have been set up have really, from what I see, my observation is kept us out of the game. I mean, our situation has nothing to do with what we know or our abilities or our intellect or anything. You know, it's based on we've allowed ourselves to be undervalued. We've allowed ourselves to be thinking we have to hold our hand out. We've allowed ourselves, I mean, when we look at some of the great musicians that we've spawned, if you go through the, what they call the fake book, 500 songs of all the greatest songs written by the John Coltranes, the Errol Gardner, people that couldn't read music, but now they study their music in colleges. They study the things that they did on their own and trying to figure out how they did it. So we continue to undervalue ourselves. I mean, I think we really, we need to wake up.
I agree. Mr. Allen, are you back with us?
Yes, I am. I was just seeing who wanted to do what here.
Yeah, because we're getting bad communication. Something's happening with our communication line. I lost him a number of times, but go ahead. What is there another question? Somebody else holding, or what's happening?
I wanted to say a little.
We're fine. You're fine, Mr. Edwards.
Go ahead. M is trying to get something in.
Well, yeah,
this clear up.
And I just wanted to say a little something about the, the Blevins situation, because, you would think that when these type of situations continue to keep happening, that we would get better about dealing with it, that we would get better, that we would get, but this stuff just continues to go backwards. I mean, they don't release tapes, they don't tell you what happened, they continue to keep everybody up in the air. When you can see what has happened. I mean, the man was shot back.
Well, and, people are saying that we don't know that because we don't have the tape or et cetera, et cetera. I tend to disagree.
Holding
Let me also say this. I need to correct all of us that do it. There are two families involved here. I thought people would kind of remember. In fact, M, you definitely knew the Moore family, and so it was the Moore and Blevins family.
And the Blevins family, I knew very well.
Your father's name was Thurman Moore, was the father, and Thurman Blevins, his mother was a Miss Blevins, and she's deceased. I need to do that because the Moore family has really been disrespected as it pertains that they were the other family. In fact, they were actually the family that the money for the services, and in fact, it was the senior member of the Moore family, the Reverend Isaac Moore, who presided and officiated over the funeral two Saturdays ago. So I just need to make sure that there's absolute clarity and respect to the Moore family as well as the Blevins family. But go ahead. You had an observation about what was happening with the film and stuff like that?
Well, just, the mayor came out, I think, soon after the, tragedy.
26th of June, the mayor announced that he was going to release the, 26th of June.
And to date, that hasn't happened. And, it's really, I think it makes it just hard for the community to digest these things when, first we're told one thing and then it never happens. And you continue to see the siege of black men around the country. And we continue to, I hate to say allow it because we, that's too harsh.
You're talking also now about the brother brutally murdered in Florida a couple of days ago.
It's
happening everywhere. It's happening everywhere. They're concentrating so much on Donald Trump that there's so much local news and pain that is going on that if folks aren't really watching on their computers or you know, listening to some of the black nationwide broadcasters, you don't even know how many black folk are dying, man. Anything else, Em? Anything else tonight?
No, I guess that's it. You know, I'll listen, or I can contribute, or whatever you guys want to do.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Appreciate you tuning in. All right. Thank you, sir. Mr. Allen, I'm pushing because I understand you've got a couple more people that want to get in. Where you at, Don? Come on.
I'm right here. No, we don't have any more callers. The people in the queue now want to listen. I've checked all of them. That's what I was doing for that quick minute. And so they just want to listen. So we can continue, Mr. Edwards. Again, that call-in number is 347-426-3904. Again, that number is 347-426-3904. Phone lines are open right now. They've been open. That's the first time we gave the number out. But anyway, Mr. Edwards?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm listening, but we're getting bad communication.
Okay.
NSA must really be dealing on it. But go ahead, man. We keep.
Yeah. I just thought that was an interesting conversation with the young lady that called in, and because I just looked at the Recast website, and I mean, I don't understand where she's coming from, what she's even talking about, and who they are, because she didn't answer that question, and so I feel a little set back. But we'll be on. Next week, maybe she called back and tell us who they are and what she was talking about.
Well,
I'm in agreement with
because she also did not tell us what the leading programs or institutions were in the quote-unquote vote. And then she kind of all of a sudden confined herself to North Minneapolis. The Recast program is for the entire city of Minneapolis, not just North Minneapolis. And I was puzzled. And I think that she didn't really tell the truth when I asked her if she was the young lady who was on the program at the Urban League two Mondays ago, this past Monday. I mean, I'm not understanding why there's this need for mystery, and so I'm just not understanding, Mr. Allen.
Yeah, it's scary. We do have a caller. The line.
Oh, but, well, that's good.
The caller,
take priority. Okay. Give us the caller. Go ahead, caller.
Caller, you're live on the air, caller. Go ahead. What's your question?
Yeah.
Your name,
I'd like to go back into that mental health issue.
Okay.
Can we go back to that mental health issue?
Go right ahead. Go right ahead. Go right ahead, sir. You called it before, but go right ahead.
You know, we got all these smart people up here. We got all these educated people up here, and Black History Month will be rolling around real shortly. You never hear anybody talk about the psychological technique of the North. You know, this is where they drive you crazy in the state of Minnesota to try and write you off as crazy. Nobody never talked about that. It's like they are foolishly fearful of white people to even say that, or they don't have the testicle fortitude to even want to blur it out of their mouths. You got too many dignitary cowards up here in this state of Minnesota. That's why we can't get any solid help up here. That's why everybody has gotten that mental health money. We're not hearing from you. You're hiding in the closet. You either got the pipe in the garage or you at your girlfriend's hotel, motel, Holiday Inn, getting your little skitty Peter, either sucked, plucked, while everybody in the Black community is getting screwed over. Then when you run out of that money, you come from out of that rock, from up out of that pipe, from up out of that hotel, and then you stick your chest out and you come up with another program. These are the most program thieves, program hustling dignitaries I've seen in the North. Everybody wants the money, but don't nobody want to do the concrete work. They don't have a concrete plan, and the only thing they have to say is here. Here's the money. Go do what you want to do with it. Go do what you want to do with it.
Exactly.
You can get any help from any agencies. The agencies and entities that are supposed to be helping, they pass the buck because a lot of those people are middle-aged white people. They're ready for retirement, and they couldn't give a shit if you could eat next week. The only thing these people care about is running the state of Minnesota like it is a high-powered, high-tech plantation. When are we going to get off this plantation mentality? When are the so-called dignitary leaders are going to act like they got leadership ability? When are the sinister ministers going to quit drinking this holy Kool-Aid that's been keeping them drunk and drunk as chumps? And then when they get in there on Sunday, they don't even have the audacity to talk about the community issues. Everybody's getting houses,
yeah.
They're losing houses, but nobody's talking about that. Nobody's talking about the real issues. The real issue is this. You Negroes been getting this money too long. The free ride should have been over, and the federal government needs to put this whole state in receivership. And I'm done on that note.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for the call.
Yeah.
Mr. Edwards.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, sir. He made some valid points about what's going on, and it seems like a cycle, Mr. Edwards, this ongoing. I mean, I understand the nonprofit mechanism and that, you know, you have to do grants, you have to serve people, but the pushes, I feel, in my personal opinion, are in the wrong direction. You know, there's other things you can do from the bottom up to solve some of these problems. And I just don't
see this particular one
as being healthy for anybody. Matter of fact, it might create some trauma for some people, you know.
Well, I think it will.
Let's see what happens.
Okay,
Mr. Edwards, I did find, let me just go back, I did find the list of people who submitted programs. And I found
Let's read the names over there. Let's get the names out over the air.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
It's the Resilient 365 Project, Ripple Effect. You may vote for as many projects as you would like in this category. This category, again, is the Ripple Effect. The name, project name, Liga Latino Sabatina. If I'm pronouncing that Spanish, I'm probably tearing it up. I'm sorry. If someone knows Spanish, call in, or I can call my wife. Never mind, not going to do that. Liga Latino Sabatina. Project team, they have a list of people that are putting this together, no names that I am familiar with. That's one of them under the Ripple Effect. Second one is Tortoise at the Town Center. New public investments in the Camden area have introduced a thriving Rubber Neighborhood Library and North Market Grocery Store on the corner of 44th and Humboldt Avenue North, along Weber Parkway. One small business, HW Men's Room, is this corner. So they want to... research shows that for a new place to thrive,
well,
eight
that's,
elements
that's,
need to be included.
Excuse me, though. That's Gilberry United.
These people want to purchase a 5'2" tortoise statue to spark community conversation. That's all they want to do. They want to buy a turtle and put it. That's what they want to do. Okay, that's gonna really be wonderful.
Maybe we can put up Jefferson
next project.
David.
yeah, exactly. Or Patrick Henry. Lifting Every Voice, and what are they? The Alley newspaper is 42 years old. This is a newspaper that is you can get every – they bring it right to the door, if I'm not mistaken, and you find it wrapped up in plastic. They want to –
and it's based for years, 42 years. It's been in South Minneapolis, but go ahead. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and they want to do a deeper cultural representation that will assist in the trauma and the healing of the community. Well, you got to get the community has to be able to read first, okay? So that's that. The next one is Minnesota Black Girl Magic. Oh, my friends here. Kendra Bars, Mika Bowie, a couple other folks, some names. I know those two names. I know Miss Bowie well. She's really cool. And so what they want to do is provide encouragement to black girls battling negative societal messages concerning their beauty and health through self-empowerment. That's kind of like what a couple other folks are doing. Okay, the next one is Activism Requires Healing. This is our friend of the shows, Ralph Crowder, and Dr. Makeda Zulu Galipsi. And they want to do some stuff in the community with drumming, dance, heal our way to full family, understand how so we don't repeat the negative patterns. Community Target family, El Capi family, Google
family.
Let
me cut you off for just a second. Do these, what you're reading, you're not reading any dollar amount. The dollar amount hasn't been inserted yet. Is that what this is?
Well, these are like three different levels. And so, like, the first level is the ripple effect. So that might be that $2,500. I might be mistaken. If someone knows and you can call and correct me, I'd greatly appreciate it. I'm just going off this document here. The last one is Next Step Narrative, Medicine Works. Constance Rhodes, Reverend Nicole Smith, Reverend Sly Jones with two E's. Our victims of gunshot wounds are the 28. Use narrative with a medicine approach by working with them individually. They want to deal with people that have been shot, stabbed, and do some trauma that way. The next one here, I'm trying to speed up a little bit because we got 9 minutes. Is the Twin Cities Recovery Social Club. Increase participants' key definition of components dealing with trauma, like a think tank, grade age is 18 to 55 years old. Fair School Peach, peer education activists for community healing. You should never teach activism in school. But anyway, they want to target audience to be high school students who attend Fair. They want to keep it all inclusive and reside in North Minneapolis, Phillips, and South Minneapolis. Students will be in grade 10 to 12 and will be African-American, Native, Latina, and white, ages 15 to 18. Let me just go down and see if I find an interesting one, which I think I just might find. Oh, here we go. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I scanned over this a minute before we got back together here, and there's one that I just need to put out there. Soon as I find it, well, you got one that's a community-based birth trauma response team for families affected by incarceration at the state. See, the state's even on this. Project team, state, local adult juvenile correctional facilities, Department of Pediatrics, University of Minnesota, culturally reproductive health care providers. Those are people that do the abortion, by the way, for those that don't know. Farrington Llewellyn, the Black Identity Series, mental health. West Broadway Area Coalition. It's a two-part inmate video interviews on Black identity theme, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Signifying, this is another one, project name, Signifying and Testifying Storytelling Festival. Lucy and Nathaniel Zulu, Caleb Zulu Gillespie, Pastor Darren Gillespie, Dylan Lindsay, Storytellers Alliance. They want to tell stories. Let me see here. Mohammed, the former assistant director at the Council on Black Minnesotans, when it was named that, as the Service to Opportunity, a.k.a. Servtunity. That was clever. Let me just see.
These are all entities that are applying for that part of that $1.6 million. Is that right? Wow.
Yeah, of money. You have schools. Oh, here you go. The Healing Center. Pastor Brian Heller, Heron, James Bean.
I'm sorry.
Darren.
You're talking about the Reverend Brian Heron, who's the pastor at Zion Baptist Church. You say he is the, what is he? Well, what is he? Read that again, please. That's a powerful, he's a powerful leader.
Yeah. Yes, he is. And he married my wife and I, by the way. Project name is called The Healing Center. Project team is Brian Heron, Reverend Pastor Brian Heron, James Bean, pastor with a social work degree, Daryl Gillespie, pastor, Paul Slack, Northandel Zulu, storyteller.
Brian's brother-in-law. Oh, okay. Uh-huh.
Okay. Okay, William Harris, drummer. Allison Sidman, yoga instructor. Rosalind Sullivan, pastor. Mary Jo Winston, pastor. Healing Circles through North Minneapolis Community. Healing Circles are cooperative and conscious effort.
And,
in which
and do they have an address or a link so that we can send our trauma-affected people to get services there? Where are they located?
That information is not in here. This information is not in here. My little brother is in here. Oh, my God. He didn't even tell me. Restoring Hope, Increasing Resilience, and Creating Impact. Constance Rhodes, Carlson David, and for full disclosure, my little brother, Winston Allen. So he didn't tell me about this, but I'm getting ready to bust him out when I talk to him on the phone tonight after the show. Internet workshops and healing circles to reduce the trauma, stress, increase resiliency, and store hope in communities responding to trauma. Through September 2000, we will engage in community members in 4 events, healing circles. Well, you know, he's a pastor and he's a herbalist, so that's probably why he's there. Target audience is North Minneapolis, and he lives in, okay, he works over there too. Lucy Laney students, age 9 to 12, Cleveland, 98% African American.
Okay. Well, it had been good, too, because there were a lot of children at the vigil last night that the Reverend Jerry McAfee and some of the ministers brought about, over 100 and some people there. A lot of children. Man, those children could have used that healing expertise. And I have to say that for our listening audience, particularly some that I expected to call in and we hadn't heard from, because there were a lot of babies, a lot of children, and et cetera, that were brought there by their parents, you know, to deal with the trauma, but at the same time to maintain and have an appreciation for peace and tranquility and et cetera. So,
yeah, I just...
Wow, the Reverend
Brian
Barron.
Know.
Okay, all right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I just want everybody to know that I am actually going to vote for this one right now that I just saw. It's 11 Points of Light with Mr. Team Project Team Sharif Willis. Is a program of the Minneapolis Urban League. 11 Points of Light is a program of the Minneapolis Urban League offered in partnership with concerned and committed communities. We look at communities we live in and see too far too many lives wasted and potential. Wasted potential that has been squandered. We have trained 11 members from various organizations to identify and address levels of trauma that will exist in our community. It's trauma that may be identified as trauma based on unforeseen violent events or adverse trauma that presents itself over time. Target communities, community greatly impacted by trauma. Mr. Sharif Willis.
All right, give that name again, Mr. Allen, and who the principals are.
It's called 11 Points of Light. And the project team it has listed on the official City of Minneapolis document is Mr. Sharif Willis.
Okay.
So, yeah, all make sure you all go out and vote for Mr. Willis. He's a good man. Let me see here. We got one. I'm going to skip that because that's not interesting. I wouldn't vote for that. And I'm not going to go through all of them, but I'm just trying to see. Oh, man. Hey. 612 Rocks. Deidre Heron Slack, Pastor Paul Slack, and Pastor Brian Heron. This is the second one. So they put in multiple. That's cool. They partner. They're networking. I like that. Woohoo.
Wow. And there are some contracts with them between them and Belcorp, the Civil Rights Department. I wonder if there's some possibility of conflict of interest. But, City Attorney Susan Siegel can answer that question. Let's make sure that we highlight a little bit next week. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Because those are some powerful ministers there. Yes, sir. I don't see, I haven't seen any of them at the Shack, or whatever. He was at the event at the Urban League, and I know we're running out of time. He was at the event at the Urban League, and he stood up and, you know, waxed. But he's been tied in with Isaiah. I thought they were all working with Isaiah. Are they abandoned Isaiah, or are they just covering for Isaiah?
I don't know. Isaiah. I don't know what to say. Oh, that was really terrible. But I don't know. Heard Isaiah. I went to a couple meetings, but I wasn't impressed. So I don't know what they're doing and what's going on. But we have a lot more. We can talk about the rest of them next week.
Next week, we have an obligation. All right, now let James Brown, who's not trying to get any kind of money, take us home. Oh, that's right. He's deceased.
Say it loud. I'm black and proud.